Mustafa knew he was dying. The old tailor's lungs felt like an arid desert. He half expected sand to gush forth with every dry cough. His wife, Ruhi, had found him on his hands and knees in his workshop, wheezing like a dying boar. She bathed him and helped him rest, but it did him no good. He only got worse, growing weaker with every passing day. She stayed by his side day and night, her hands wrapped around his. She prayed that Allah would spare her husband, but Mustafa knew better. It was not Allah's will that had caused him to fall ill. It was their son. Mustafa knew the boy was a rascal. He did not have good manners at supper. He mumbled through his prayers and would spend all day running about the streets with the other irresponsible children. If he was not careful, his son would grow up to be a thug or a bandit. And Mustafa could not have that. One day, Mustafa had caught his son before he left in the morning and sat him down in the workshop. He told the boy that he must learn a trade, or he'll be left behind by the world with the beggars and the thieves. But as Mustafa did his best to pass on his expertise, the boy's gaze kept straying from the thread toward the open window. Mustafa had pricked him with a needle to ensure he was paying attention. In retaliation, the boy had grabbed the bolt of cloth off the table and thrown it on the floor, stomping it for good measure. Then he ran out the door, not watching to see his father's disappointed gaze. It was then that the illness struck Mustafa, bringing him to his knees. The timing was not a coincidence. Mustafa's heart gave out when he realized his son was hopeless. He was dying of grief because that rascal, Aladdin, would never amount to anything. I'm Vanessa Richardson. You're listening to Tales, a Parcast original. Every other Saturday, we dive into the dark origins of another fairy tale. You can find all episodes of Tales and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Tales for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Tales in the search bar. The tales on this podcast are dark, sometimes scary, and full of adult themes. As a warning, the original story of Aladdin features depictions of death, violence, manipulative behavior, racism, xenophobia, and flippant depictions of slavery. Please exercise caution for children under 13. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. Today, we're beginning the story of Aladdin's Wonderful Lamp, an iconic Middle Eastern fairy tale about a lazy boy whose life is changed when he discovers a magical lamp. Since its first appearance in the 18th century, Aladdin has become one of the most famous fairy tales in the world and has been translated into almost every language. Aladdin's Wonderful Lamp was first introduced to the Western world in the legendary collection of Eastern folktales, 1001 Nights. Alongside Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, and the legend of Sinbad the Sailor, Aladdin is one of the most famous stories in this collection. However, this story in particular is not a part of the original Arabic text. It was added to 1001 Nights in 1717 by French translator Antoine Galland. Galland was the first European to translate 1001 Nights, and all early English versions are based on his interpretation. Several of the tales he added to 1001 Nights, including both Aladdin and Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, are called the Orphan Stories, a nod to their absence in the Arabic version. The original story of Aladdin was told to Galland by Syrian storyteller Hanna Diab. Though Diab only received brief mentions in Galland's diary, he is now believed to be the true author of Aladdin by historians, following the discovery of his memoirs in 1993. Diab's life story contains several parallels with the story of Aladdin, particularly an incident where a traveler claiming to possess magical powers invited Diab to go on a treasure-hunting adventure with him. On his first tomb-raiding expedition, Diab found both a ring and a lamp. These items may have planted a seed in his imagination that eventually grew to become the tale of Aladdin and the Wonderful Lamp. Life was good for Aladdin. A boy of 15 years old, he didn't have a care in the world. He lived in a small hovel with his mother, but that didn't bother him. He only went home to sleep and eat, after all. His days were spent running up and down the street with the other boys, playing pranks on traders in the bazaar, and gawking at visitors from far-off lands. As far as Aladdin was concerned, the city of Al-Khalas was the perfect place to live. He had friends, he enjoyed himself, and he no longer had an overbearing father trying to teach him a trade. He couldn't imagine anything better. Until he ran into a stranger from a far-off land. Aladdin was out, as always, chasing his friends through the narrow alleyways, when he turned a corner and collided with a tall, robed man, falling onto his back. Dusting himself off, he stood to resume his game. But then the stranger caught him by the arm. Aladdin fought to free himself, but the man's grip was like iron. The stranger was tall, with dark skin and a piercing gaze. His beard came to a point on his chin, and an ornate cane was clutched between his fingers, though he did not appear to need it to walk. There was a curious look in the older man's eyes that caused Aladdin to stop struggling. The stranger asked, his voice soft as sand, "Where do you think you are going, boy?"
"None of your business," Aladdin retorted. "Who are you?"
"My name is Nasrallah. I come from the land of the setting sun, and I have been looking for you."
Suddenly, the man burst into tears and wrapped his arms around Aladdin. Aladdin was too shocked to do anything but accept the embrace and wait for the man to stop crying. When he pulled away, Nasrallah wiped his eyes and offered a hurried explanation. He had heard of the death of Aladdin's father and had come all the way from his home in Morocco to see what had become of his brother's family. Aladdin blinked in surprise. Brother? He didn't know his father had a brother. But Nasrallah's outpouring of emotion was so earnest, he couldn't help but believe him. Nasrallah told Aladdin to hold out his hands. Aladdin complied, and he deposited 2 gold dinars into them. Aladdin gaped at the money. He had never seen so much gold in his life. Nasrallah told Aladdin to take the coins to his mother and have her prepare a meal. He would dine with his nephew and sister-in-law tonight. Aladdin returned home early that afternoon. His mother, Ruhi, nearly knocked over her loom in shock when he came through the door. She clearly had not been expecting him until supper. Aladdin handed her the money and told her what Nasrallah had told him. Ruhi's eyebrows knit in confusion. She told her son that Mustafa indeed had a brother, but he was long dead. This strange man must be an imposter. Aladdin insisted she must be mistaken.
"He cried upon meeting me, saying he saw my resemblance to his brother."
Ruhi finally relented and prepared a meal for that evening. When Nasrallah showed up that night, he greeted Ruhi with a hug, which she accepted with a little hesitation. Ruhi looked him up and down. "How do you know my late husband?" Aladdin was confused by how she phrased the question, since he had already told her they were brothers. Nasrallah smiled and began his story. "Mustafa and I traveled together for many years when we were young, but as we crossed the desert, a terrible storm separated us. I assumed my brother had died, so I settled in the Maghreb. News of his survival and eventual death reached me only a week ago, and I traveled here to see what became of his family." It seemed a perfectly reasonable explanation to Aladdin. His mother seemed to let her guard down after that. As they sat down to Ruhi's delicious feast, Nasrallah turned to Aladdin. "So, young man, what trade did my dear departed brother teach you?" Aladdin was silent. For the first time in his life, he felt shame for having spent his entire youth playing with the street urchins and neglecting his studies. He bowed his head, mumbling,
"I don't know a trade."
Nasrallah exclaimed, "What? Your mother spins yarn to support you both and you have not yet learned a trade? What an ungracious child you are." Aladdin's head bowed even lower until he was an inch away from smothering himself in his own supper. "Well," Nasrallah continued, stroking his beard, "if your father's trade was not to your liking, perhaps I can teach you my own. How would you like to learn how to be a merchant? Do you fancy people calling you Khwaja?" Aladdin perked up immediately. He would rather be a gentleman merchant than the lowly tailor his father had wanted him to be. He cast a glance over to his mother, whose eyes had already filled with hopeful tears. They both begged this strange man to mentor Aladdin. Nasrallah's lips curled into a smile. Of course he would. He would come and visit early the next morning and take Aladdin on a tour of the merchant's quarter. After the meal, Nasrallah departed, leaving his promise hanging in the air behind him. Aladdin did not sleep a wink that night. He lay in his small bedroom, picturing himself as a wealthy and prosperous trader, known from Arabia to the cities of China. Khwaja Aladdin, he fancied himself. The title suited him well. True to his word, Nasrallah knocked on his door before dawn. Aladdin barely had time to dress himself before the strange Moroccan whisked him out the door and into the bustling streets of Al-Khalas. Nasrallah led Aladdin into the hammam baths, where Aladdin had the dirt of the streets washed away from him. Then they went to a clothing store, where Nasrallah had the merchant give Aladdin a suit of fine silks. Refreshed, they set off again, weaving their way through the bazaar. As they went, Nasrallah pointed out each merchant stand to Aladdin, explaining the ins and outs of his chosen occupation. Once they were through with the merchant's quarter, Nasrallah brought Aladdin to the richest parts of the city, even showing him the gates of the Sultan's palace. By the time the sun dipped low in the horizon, Aladdin's head was spinning with all he had learned. He asked Nasrallah if they should be heading home now. Nasrallah replied, "We have only one last stop to make before we return." He took Aladdin by the shoulders and guided the boy out of the city, following a path that only he could see as the sky darkened above them. Then, when the city was almost completely out of sight behind the hills, Nasrallah stopped and said, "Here is where you will make your fortune." Nasrallah reached into his pocket and brought out a small box. He opened it, and the scent of incense struck Aladdin's nostrils, making him gag. The Moroccan began to mutter strange words under his breath. The sand shifted around their feet as if sculpted by an invisible wind. Aladdin watched, dumbfounded. Where the sand once was, there appeared a large stone slab with a copper ring fixed to it. Aladdin was horrified. He didn't know Nasrallah could do magic. He had been told never to trust wizards, sorcerers, or magicians. Consumed by panic, he turned to flee back to the safety of the city. Moving faster than Aladdin thought possible, Nasrallah caught the boy by his new silk collar. Then he struck Aladdin with the back of his other hand. Aladdin sprawled onto the dirt, nose bleeding.
"Why did you hit me so, Uncle?"
Nasrallah looked at him with blazing eyes.
"Oh, my nephew, I want to make you a man. Do exactly as I tell you, and you will be richer than all the kings that have ever lived."
At his uncle's direction, Aladdin approached the rock and gripped it by the copper ring. He pulled with all his might. Just when he felt his muscles about to burst, the rock split in two and opened for him. Below, a stone staircase descended into the earth. A chill ran up Aladdin's spine. His uncle told him there was treasure here, but to the boy, it looked more like a tomb. In a moment, Aladdin goes underground and finds a treasure that changes his life forever. Now, back to the story. Aladdin stood with his uncle Nasrallah before the cave. He looked over to Nasrallah. The Moroccan man had been so kind to him and his mother, but had kept so many secrets. He had not told them how he knew magic, and he had not told Aladdin he would be brought to an underground vault at the end of their day out. Nasrallah brought Aladdin close and gave him instructions.
"In the cave, dear boy, you will encounter all manner of treasures. If you touch a single one, you will turn into a black stone and remain in the cave forever."
He then raised a finger.
"But in the deepest recesses of the cave, you will find a lamp. Bring it to me, and your reward will make you and your mother the richest family in your city."
Aladdin agreed.
"Just one more thing,"
Nasrallah said, placing a signet ring on the boy's finger.
"This ring will protect you from all hurt and fear you may encounter in the cave, but only if you follow my instructions to the letter."
And with that, Nasrallah stepped aside and let Aladdin enter. The air was cold as Aladdin descended. His eyes tried in vain to adjust to the gloom as he felt blindly with his hands. The rock walls closed in tighter and tighter as he passed the first archway. For a horrible moment, Aladdin worried that the walls would squeeze the air out of his lungs. Just as the thought crossed his mind, the cave opened up around him. A strange, otherworldly blue light filled the tunnel. The path ahead of him was divided into four different entryways. Each one led to a pedestal. On each pedestal was a jar full of gold. Following his uncle's advice, he did not touch them. Instead, he explored each pathway until he found one that continued past its tempting altar. The walls around him opened up once again. This time, he found himself in a lush garden full of trees. Instead of fruit, these trees bore iridescent gemstones the size of Aladdin's fists. Their light played off the walls in beautiful splashes of color. Aladdin gaped at this grove as he passed through. At the end of this grove, Aladdin spied a ladder. He took the rungs in his hands and climbed, hand over hand, until he reached the roof of the cave. In an alcove carved into the rock sat an oil lamp, a small yellow flame burning in its nozzle. With a quick breath, Aladdin extinguished the flame, then poured its contents out onto the cave floor. Once it was empty, he stored the lamp in his pocket and went back down the ladder. But on his way back, Aladdin stopped in the garden. "There is no harm in picking some of these crystalline fruits," he thought to himself. He reached up, grasped the nearest one, and twisted it off its stem. When he did not turn into obsidian, the boy breathed a sigh of relief and continued filling his pockets. As soon as he was satisfied with his haul, Aladdin made his way back toward the entrance. Every footstep was heavier than before, weighed down by the treasure burdening Aladdin's pockets. The star-filled sky sparkled pleasantly at the mouth of the cave. Aladdin lumbered his way up the stone stairs, cumbersome step by cumbersome step. But when he reached the final ledge, he realized it was too tall for him to get over by himself. Nasrallah loomed into view, cast in a burning silhouette by the campfire behind him.
"Help me up, Uncle,"
Aladdin pleaded. He had too much treasure in his pockets to lift himself out of the cave.
"Give me the lamp and lighten your load," the sorcerer commanded.
But Aladdin could not reach the lamp in his pocket. It was too buried beneath the gems. He pleaded with Nasrallah, but the magician was adamant. He would not help Aladdin up until he had the lamp in his hands. Aladdin felt the gems once more, imagining the new life they could help him lead. He couldn't part with these gems. He crossed his arms and told Nasrallah firmly,
"Either you help me out now, or I stay down here, and the lamp stays with me."
Nasrallah cursed him.
"So be it," he said.
He opened his box and began to rant in that same unintelligible language that had revealed the cave. Fire rose from the logs behind Nasrallah and circled the cave entrance. Aladdin realized his mistake and pleaded with him, but his uncle did not respond. The last thing Aladdin saw were his uncle's eyes, lit by fire, framed by shifting rock. A moment later, the stone above Aladdin's head closed, plunging him into complete darkness. Aladdin sat in the blackness, weeping. Clearly, this sorcerer was no relative of his. He had come to exploit Aladdin for some inscrutable reason. What would a man from the Maghreb want with a lamp anyway? Didn't they have lamps in Morocco? He fumbled his way into the darkness, seeing if he could find his way back to the garden, but the forked path had been blocked off as well. He was thoroughly entombed. Aladdin could not tell how long he sat underground. Days? Weeks? Years? Without the sun or any light to speak of, it did not matter. His hunger gnawed at his gut, and the air grew heavy around him. Feeling faint, he fell to his knees and prayed to Allah. He clasped his hands, imploring to be delivered from this plight. As his knuckles brushed together, he felt the cold metal of the signet ring upon his finger, Nasrallah's ring. The darkness receded ever so slightly. As soon as he had rubbed the ring, it emitted a soft red glow, like there was a flame encased within its jewel. A plume of smoke seeped through his fingers and resolved itself into a cloud before him. A man emerged, sitting cross-legged in the air. He was clad in simple trousers and a cap, but the same red glow emitted from him. Aladdin gaped in wonder. This was no man, but a jinn, a lower spirit who was bound to the ring. The jinn spoke.
"Your slave between your hands is here. Ask what you will of me. I am bound to serve whoever owns the ring."
Aladdin could not believe his luck. In his greed, Nasrallah had given him a method of escape. He whooped for joy and made his request.
"I demand that you set me upon the face of this earth."
The world around Aladdin burst into white light, rendering him temporarily blind. As his eyes adjusted, he realized he stood by the buried entrance to the cave, now in daylight. Nasrallah was nowhere to be seen, but he could smell faint incense upon the air. Not wasting any time, Aladdin ran back toward the city, hands clasped firmly around the ring that had saved his life. Aladdin's mother was weeping when he returned home. She told him he had been gone 3 days and implored to know what became of their strange benefactor. Aladdin told her the whole story, from the market street to the betrayal at the cave. He then gave the lamp to his mother. The jewels he stored away in his own room. Ruhid despaired that they were back to where they started, her without much to do besides weave yarn for a living, and him without any career prospects.
"Not so, mother," Aladdin said. "We can sell this lamp. Nasrallah wanted it so badly, it must be worth quite the handsome price."
Ruhi agreed and brought out a towel to polish the tarnished item. She had only been cleaning the lamp for a moment before a cloud of smoke burst forth from it. She recoiled in horror, but Aladdin grinned in delight. He knew what this smoke meant. Another jinn appeared before them, but this one crackled with power in a way the jinn of the ring did not. It was so large, its form filled their small hovel to the roof.
"What would you ask of me? I am a slave to whoever owns the wonderful lamp," the jinn stated.
When his mother was unable to form words, Aladdin spoke up.
"My mother and I are hungry. Would you fetch us a fine meal, please?"
"Your wish is my command," returned the jinn.
He vanished, and within moments returned with a feast fit for a king. Gold and silver trays stacked high with meats of all sizes. This feast lasted Aladdin and his mother for 2 whole days. When they had finished, Aladdin suggested rubbing the lamp again. His mother refused. She was terrified of the enormous jinn who had appeared so suddenly in her home. She thought they should get rid of the lamp immediately. Aladdin had no intention of getting rid of the lamp or the ring. As a compromise, he took the platters from their fine meal and, one at a time, brought them to market for sale. The silver in them fetched a great price, and soon Ruhi no longer needed to spin yarn to support them both. Whenever they needed more money, Ruhi left the house and Aladdin would call for the jinn of the lamp to bring them another feast on ornate trays. In this manner, summoning food and selling off the platters, Aladdin and Ruhi elevated themselves from paupers to upstanding middle-class citizens. They never revealed where their prosperity came from and continued living in their modest hovel, not wanting to invite any undue scrutiny from their neighbors, Aladdin's change in status brought with it a change in character. He no longer wasted his time playing in the streets with the other poor boys. Instead, he spent his days at the market, learning as much as he could from the merchants and travelers there. As he grew from a boy into a man, he became known to every shopkeeper in the bazaar. One day, while at the market, a loud exclamation caught Aladdin's ear. A messenger from the palace spread the word throughout the market street. Everyone was to shut their doors the following day and not venture out. The Sultan's daughter, Lady Badr al-Badur, was paying a visit to the hammam bathhouse, and no one was to look upon her. This was punishable by death. But while all his merchant friends humbly complied with this decree, Aladdin's interest was piqued. There was still a glimmer of mischief within him. He had heard rumors of the lady's beauty, and he wanted to see if they were true. When the day arrived, Aladdin stationed himself in the corner behind the door of the hammam bathhouse, waiting in tense anticipation. Sure enough, at around midday, the door to the bathhouse creaked open, and a woman entered, alone. Aladdin watched from the shadows as she lifted the veil from her face. Aladdin could not believe his eyes. Gazing upon the face of Badr al-Badur, Aladdin offered a silent prayer to Allah, thanking him for creating such great beauty. The lady turned, and Aladdin pressed against the wall, squeezing himself into the door's shadow. He wanted nothing more than to profess undying love and loyalty to this woman, but if she saw him here, he would lose his head. Her eyes gazed in Aladdin's direction. He kept himself as still as he dared, staring back into her stunning auburn eyes. Aladdin was an inch away from death, staring at the loveliest woman in the world. He had never been so afraid and so entranced at the same time. The moment passed, and Badr al-Badur went to prepare her bath. Aladdin slipped out the window onto the empty street. As he stole his way back towards his hovel, the face of the lady never left his mind. He would not rest until he could have this woman for his wife. Up next, Aladdin attempts the impossible and proposes to the Sultan's daughter. Now back to the story. The Sultan was pleased with his own reputation. He was exceedingly popular amongst his own people for his open and generous manner. Every day he would hold court in his palace and invite any citizen, rich or poor, to air their grievances before him. He was a truly magnanimous ruler. And while the Sultan dealt with the concerns of the people, his Grand Vizier, Idris, dealt with the concerns of the state. Together, they were a perfect match, a genial face for the people and a hard fist for the politicians. As he held court one day, the Sultan called Idris over to his side.
"Look here. I am almost certain that woman has been standing in the corner every day for the last few weeks."
The vizier nodded. He had also noticed her, a pauper who waited at the gates like all the other concerned citizens, but never came up to speak. Her presence puzzled these two men.
"Come forward, my dear woman,"
the Sultan commanded, indicating the pauper. She shuffled to him, eyes cast downward. He continued,
"Explain to me why you came to visit my palace."
The woman was silent for a moment. Then she requested all the courtiers and advisors be sent away, What she had to say was for the Sultan's ears alone. Burhan al-Din was baffled by this request, but his confusion was overruled by his curiosity. The Sultan had the room cleared until its only occupants were himself, the strange woman, and Idris. Finally, the woman rose to meet his gaze. She introduced herself as Ruhi and gave a strange request. Her son Aladdin had fallen so deeply in love with Badr al-Badur, he no longer took any pleasure in life. He barely ate, did not sleep, and every time he spoke, it was only of her. She said that her son requested to take Lady Badr al-Badur for his wife. The Sultan and Vizier burst into peals of laughter, and yet the woman remained stone-faced. She brought a bowl out from beneath her robe and uncovered it. Light of all different colors issued forth, causing the Sultan to squint. As his eyes adjusted, he realized that the bowl was full of enormous iridescent gems, each one larger than the finest he possessed. He couldn't believe it. This peasant woman held in her hands as much wealth as his entire treasury. This is what Ruhi's son was offering for the lady's hand. Burhan al-Din stroked his beard, considering. He exchanged a glance with Idris. No matter how much wealth this woman had, her rough clothing showed that her son was not a good match for Badr al-Badur. And on top of this, Badr al-Badur was betrothed to marry Idris's son, Ekram. This proposal could not stand. And yet the Sultan wanted those gemstones. He rose from his throne and approached the bowing woman.
"We thank you for such a kingly gift. We will consent to your terms. In 3 months' time, my daughter will be married to your son."
This, he reasoned, was the safest option. In 3 months, these vagrants would have forgotten about their foolish ploy. He took the gems from the woman himself, and she rose shakily to her feet. Her eyes were wide with disbelief. A wise woman, the Sultan thought. Some part of her suspects I do not intend to marry my daughter off to a beggar. But he smiled at her and thanked her for coming all this way. She turned and exited, leaving the Sultan twice as rich as he was before. The next 3 months passed with agonizing slowness for Aladdin. After his many visits to the jeweler, he knew that the gems he took from the underground garden must be the greatest dowry the Sultan had ever seen. Why did he have to wait for 3 months to wed? And then he heard why. A rumor floated through the streets, soon confirmed by a lavish wedding procession. Badr al-Badur was to be married off to the Grand Vizier's son, Ikram. Aladdin despaired, withdrawing into his rooms, not opening his doors for anyone. Sometime later, Ruhi entered with more foul tidings.
"My son, I have news for you. The vizier's son weds Badr al-Badur tonight. Tonight, they will share a bed for the first time."
Something in his mother's words brought Aladdin out of his stupor. A bed. An idea sparked in Aladdin's mind. His tears dried, and he felt an impish grin spreading over his face. That night, Aladdin sat in his room, listening to the sounds of the wedding festival drift through the streets. He took out the lamp and rubbed it. At once, the jinn appeared, ready to receive Aladdin's command. Aladdin gave instructions to the jinn.
I want you to follow Badr al-Badur and her new husband. When they lay together tonight, you will bring their wedding bed here straight away." The jinn responded,
"I hear and obey."
Then he vanished. Aladdin sat upright and waited for their arrival. Aladdin had almost nodded off to sleep when another flash of light filled the room. An ornate bridal bed appeared before him. A man and a woman were upon it, screaming in shock. The man was naked, one leg raised as if he had been frozen in fear while straddling the woman. The jinn floated beside the tableau of interrupted bliss, waiting for his next command. Aladdin gave it.
"Take this man and throw him into the privy."
The jinn threw the naked Ikram over his shoulder and carried him out of the room, blowing cold air on his nether regions as he went. Aladdin approached the bed. Lying on it, covers pulled protectively up to her nose, was Lady Badr al-Badur. Seeing the fear in her eyes, Aladdin stopped. He raised both hands in a placating gesture.
"Lady Badr al-Badur, I do not wish you any harm. I simply brought you here to prevent the wrong man from enjoying you. Please, rest yourself."
With that, Aladdin brought out a scimitar and placed it on the covers. He lay down on top of the covers beside her. The sword lay between them, a promise that he would rather die than attempt to ravish her. She watched him fearfully, but he did not move from his spot or make a single attempt to touch her. Aladdin spent the whole night smiling, content that the princess was not spending the night in another man's company. The next morning, Aladdin got off the covers and allowed the jinn to return Ikram to the bed. The jinn then transported it away. Aladdin stretched and went to wash himself. The night could not have gone better, he thought, congratulating himself on his elegant solution. Not only had he prevented the consummation of their marriage, but no doubt the vizier's son would fear going into his lady's bed ever again. The next day, the wedding feast continued. It was the talk of the town, a wedding so lavish that it lasted two nights. Aladdin observed this wryly, noting how envious all the people were of Ikram and his new bride. They would not be so jealous if they knew what had befallen them last night, Aladdin thought to himself. That night, he called the jinn from the lamp and once again commanded him to bear the couple's marriage bed to him as soon as they both lay upon it. Aladdin proceeded to do exactly what he had the night before, having Ikram thrown into the privy and laying beside Badr al-Badur with a sword between them. The next morning, he had the couple spirited back. The Sultan was perplexed. Both his daughter and the Grand Vizier's son should be happy, but neither of them spoke much at all to their parents following their wedding night. They wore the expressions of a couple who had spent two nights in a dank cave rather than the second grandest room in the palace. This confusion grew into fury for the Sultan. After everything he had done to make sure their wedding was the most joyous wedding of all time, they showed him no gratitude, not even a word of thanks. The young could be so ungrateful. On the second day, he opened the doors of their bedchamber to find his new son-in-law shivering with cold and his daughter's eyes wide with fright. Ikram ran out of the room before the Sultan had a chance to interrogate him. The Sultan adopted a soothing voice, trying to calm the resentment bubbling in his gut.
"Tell me, daughter, what has happened to make you look so distressed?
Does your new husband displease you?
The Sultan asked. His daughter shook her head, once again refusing to tell him what was the matter. He had enough of her silence. Enraged, he unsheathed his saber and brandished it over his head. Bedral Bahadur fell to her knees, begging her father to have mercy on her. Trembling, she told him everything that had befallen them the last two nights. The Sultan called for Ikram, who gave the same account. He would not lie with Bedral Bahadur another night for fear of the jinn's wrath. Burhan al-Din despaired. How could such a promising match have earned the ire of a jinn? It was utterly baffling. He turned this story over and over in his head all day as he sat upon his throne, trying to figure out some reason behind it. The Sultan was so distracted, he barely noticed when the mysterious woman, Ruhi, entered his throne room later that day. His heart stopped when he met her gaze. The promise he made her came rushing back into his mind. She spoke up quickly this time.
My lord, now is the time you promised your daughter would marry my son. I pray you fulfill this promise.
The Sultan stood, mind working fast. The idea of marrying his daughter off to a tramp's son still revolted him, but he could not go back on a promise. Before he could take a step off of his throne, Idris stepped forward. The vizier spoke, cajoling the old woman. He assured her that they would fulfill the promise, but that Lady Bedral Bahadur's hand was worth more than a bowl of gems. They would need another bowl of gems, along with 40 platters of gold dust, carried by 40 white slave girls, accompanied by 40 black eunuchs. The woman bowed without protest and left the chamber. The Sultan clapped his vizier on the back heartily.
Well done, my good friend. By giving her an impossible task, you have protected my daughter against marrying an impoverished stranger.
Idris smiled. He was honored to be of service, he said. He would have prevented this intrusion, even if it was not his son set to marry Lady Bedral Bahadur. But before an hour had passed, a strange noise came from outside the palace. The Sultan and his Grand Vizier sent a servant out to the street to determine what was causing such a racket. Aladdin's heart swelled with pride as he rode his horse down the streets. Clad in the finest robes money could buy, he was unrecognizable to the people of Al-Khalas. He thrust his hands into his saddlebags, bringing out fistfuls of gold dinars, which he cast into the crowds. Behind him were 80 slaves, 40 black eunuchs, and 40 white women, each carrying a tray piled high with gold dust. The Sultan's ludicrous request was no challenge for a jinn. Aladdin only needed to give the spirit an exact description, and in under an hour, he had all the gold, gems, and slaves he needed to impress the Sultan. Seeing the magnificent caravan approach, the palace door cracked open in welcome. This was all that Aladdin had ever wanted: adoration, respect, and soon, a beautiful bride. How unambitious he had been all those years ago when the Maghrebi sorcerer plucked him from obscurity. Though the man was a deceitful rogue, he had, in a way, delivered on his promise. Aladdin would be among the richest and most respected noblemen the city had ever known. And the Sultan would never know that the man he welcomed in as a prince had once been a lowly tailor's son. In our next episode, Aladdin enjoys his new status, becoming the most famous man in Al-Khalas. But with fame comes increased scrutiny, and a dark figure from Aladdin's past learns of his newfound success. Thanks for listening to Tales. We'll be back in 2 weeks with part 2 of Aladdin. You can find more episodes of Tales and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Tales, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Tales on Spotify, just open the app and type Tales in the search bar. Several of you have asked how to help us. Well, if you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time. Tales was created by Max Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Michael Langsner. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Tales was written by Robert Teamstra. I'm Vanessa Richardson.